It's 5 p.m. This is Icy Radio. Hello and welcome to a very special edition of iScience Radio. It's the 17th of December 2018 and we are broadcasting live from the Science Communication Unit at Imperial College London for the final episode of 2018. This is our iScience Christmas special. I'm Jason, Director of Production at iScience, and joining me in the studio is our wonderful radio editor, anchor and full-time legend, Dr. Hilary Guyte.
I'm blushing!
Hilary's led us through 11 fascinating episodes with over 30 panellists and discussing the weird, wonderful and outright wacky bits of science that this term has brought us.
Oh, but what a brilliant term it's been. And today we celebrate. To celebrate, we're going to go over some of the best bits of iScience Radio since our first episode on Monday, the 1st of October. There were some brave souls who came into the studio with me and Jason, and they hadn't even started their induction. iScience Radio has explored the past and the present of science and the exciting but equally terrifying potential futures of human life. And we have not shied away from any big questions, have we?
We have not. And over the next hour, you'll be hearing what we thought about liars, transhumanists, Christmas adverts, and we'll finally get Hilary to clarify what on earth she means by her thingy thing things.
The yellow thingy thing things. And we're also going to be joined by iScience editor, co-editor Aoife, to take a look at the brand new iScience magazine, the one all about the Earth, out now. So go and grab your coffee out on the newsstands on campus, the ones already in your bag that you're reading, and come and join us.
Yeah, it's a fantastic production. All of that is to come between now and 6 p.m. right here on IC Radio.
The radio show where we talk about science, we have fun with science, and we play some really cool records. This is iScience Radio.
And as usual, don't forget to get in touch with us. You can do that by heading to icradio.com/contact, leave your name and a little message, and we'll receive it here in the studio.
And normally at this point in the show, we would head across to iScience News with Madeline, but she's on a much-deserved holiday.
She is indeed. So this week, we thought we'd pick some of our favourite news stories from this term on iScience Radio.
This is iScience Radio News.
Hi everyone, it's Madeline, news editor here at iScience, and I'm here this week to give you a special science roundup. The US Supreme Court has announced that it will allow a historic kids' climate lawsuit to go forward. The children, who include 21 people ranging in age from 11 to 22, allege that the government has violated their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property by failing to prevent dangerous climate change. They are asking the district court to order the federal government to prepare a plan that will ensure the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere falls below 350 parts per million by 2100, down from an average of 405 parts per million in 2017. Next, scientists at a water testing laboratory in Swindon have found that all wet wipes sold as flushable in the UK have so far failed the water industry's disintegration tests. Wet wipes are thought to be behind 80% of blockages in the UK sewers, costing £100 million a year to deal with. Whilst the government has said it is working with manufacturers to develop a product that does not contain plastic and can be safely flushed, for the time being the water companies insist that only the three P's should go down the toilet. Pee, poo and paper. Finally, the earliest known painting of an animal has been identified in a cave on the island of Borneo. The artwork, which is at least 40,000 years old, is thought to be the oldest example of figurative painting, where real objects are depicted rather than abstract shapes. The researchers aren't certain what animal it represents, but their hunch is that it's a banteng, a kind of wild cow that lives in the area today. The work appears in Nature Journal. And that's all we've got time for here. Merry Christmas, everyone. We'll be back next year with more science news.
So thanks, Madeline and the news team, for the great work you've done over the past 3 months. Every single week, some fantastic news stories. And I love that flushing toilet.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. It's been great to work with Maddie and her ever-growing news team every week. And we'll be doing the same again from Monday, the 7th of January next year.
So now to start today's show, we're going to look at the past, and this was something we did quite early on when we talked about lying.
So back on our very first show on the 1st of October, we discussed the science of lying, what lying is, why we do it, how we do it more often than not. And we actually concluded that human interactions and society would struggle to function, at least in the way that our relationships work, without lying. Then Hilary and I decided to test out how good our panel of humans, Bernadetta, Sam, Lily, Juanita, Tristan and Ant, were at detecting a lie.
I have heard that it's easier to lie than it is to tell if someone else is lying. So I thought we would play a little game actually in the studio. So Hilary and I are going to talk about our breakfast this morning. One of us is telling the truth, but one of us is lying. So I'm going to ask you, Hilary, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had vegetable sausages and I had tomatoes. And so anyone who knew me last year knows we've just had our house renovated and we've got this hob. And it's amazing. You can actually cook tomatoes in about 2 minutes. It's incredible. And the sausages in about three.
Lovely. Now, I had two bacon sandwiches this morning. But not only were they bacon sandwiches, they had cheese in them. And they had tomatoes. And they had lettuce. And they smelled so good when the bacon was frying this morning. Yeah, I loved it. What else did I have for breakfast? Oh, I had some coffee on the side.
Two BLTs.
I had basically two BLTs, gluten-free BLTs. Gluten-free bread's always smaller, by the way. So that's my justification. Now, who was lying? Should we go around? Let's go around.
I think you were lying.
Me?
Yeah.
I agree.
The reason for
I
it?
I agree.
Okay, can I say the reason for it?
Same.
I think you were too explicit, because people tend to start to explain themselves within the lie that they're telling.
And you said whether it was good or not, which I think, Hilary, you just said matter-of-factly what you had and then didn't dress up your whether you liked it or not.
I did tell you how I cooked it.
But this could have been a previous breakfast that you fondly remembered, I suppose, rather than the breakfast you had today.
So should we reveal who was lying?
I'm going to call you bluff and I'm going to say that you were telling the truth and Hilary was lying.
Why?
Well, I felt like you were making I mean, obviously, this isn't transferable radio.
This is hey, anyone can see our body language.
Yeah. We're all really, really attractive, by the way, just for anyone listening. I feel like your eye signals were too kind of forced into a bit sort of stuttering, not quite. So maybe I'm just getting ahead of myself, but yeah.
So, consensus.
Yeah, go on. What's the general consensus?
I'll settle into these and
change my decision now.
Okay.
Hilary, I think you were lying.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're getting there. I was lying.
Hilary was lying.
Yeah. Oh.
I know.
Oh. Oh. So you did
the girls
two
didn't pick up on that.
I did. There are two small BLTs.
Two small BLTs, okay.
And cheese. So we've all
in
heard,
the sandwich?
Yeah,
sorry.
in the sandwich.
Is that a normal breakfast for you?
No, I just ran out of milk. I had to get the bacon out. Anyway, we've all heard that going into too much detail when we're lying is a common thing. But actually, what we saw with Hilary was a perfect example because she sort of avoided the subject. She started talking about her new kitchen and how she could roast her tomatoes or whatever. No one really cared about that. They cared about what the sandwich or what the breakfast tasted like and the actual components of the breakfast. So this is something they went into in great detail in the documentary. So it's about what we put emphasis on when we're explaining if we're being truthful or not. I'm not trying to give you tips here on how to lie, by the way.
I've heard various things about, you've probably all heard of this thing called neuro-linguistic programming and whether people look to the right or the left and whether they're looking at constructed images that they've dreamt up, or if they look to the left, they're looking at remembered images. But equally, as I was trying to allude to, you could look at a remembered image and someone could say, well, they're telling the truth, but actually it's out of context and it's a breakfast you might have had weeks ago.
So I've just got some listener feedback here and it goes, liar, liar, pants are on fire. Thank you, listener.
You know, that was one of the programmes that made me change my views a bit. In fact, most of the programmes we've done, I have changed what I do or what I think. I hate lying, I hate liars, but I do understand sometimes little ones are allowed.
And it's not just sort of the black and white between truth and a lie, is there? There's sort of this in-between thing where you're omitting kind of certain facts, and just the way that humans work, if we were honest to each other 100% of the time, I don't think that society would be the way it is, how we know it, to be honest. And from the past to the present, now it's time to have a look at some of the science that is happening right now. In October, when we started doing the show, the Nobel Prizes were just being announced.
And I'm sure you're all aware the Nobel Prizes are at the cutting edge of what's possible within science. So trying to understand the award-winning research as a mere mortal can be a bit of a challenge.
It really can. So that's why on our show about the Nobel Prizes, Hillary tried to use a simple analogy that would help us understand something very complicated.
Can I be silly now?
Yeah.
Go for it. Okay, fine. So now... I don't think you've seen the yellow thingy tweet about Nobel Prizes, have you?
No, not at all.
So I just love this because it made sense to me. So there is a guy who said, my dad just won the Nobel Prize for putting the red thingy into the blue thingy so that it hooks onto the yellow thingy. So, and I thought, oh, what, really? Anyway, it's real. So his dad is George Smith, and he developed a phage display, which is a bacteriophage. So that's where a virus... Do we all know what viruses are compared to bacteria?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Go on then, tell me.
Oh gosh, I wasn't prepared.
It's an exam now.
Exactly.
Unlike a bacteria, which is a living organism, so it's a cell, so it's got a metabolism, a virus is simply just a genetic sort. It might be RNA or DNA, so just
a kind of strandy thing, isn't it?
It's a strand of genes, kind of like wrapped in a kind of protein coat, and because it hasn't got any sort of metabolism, it's not
protein
able...
coat. You've said the right thing. That's the blue thingy.
Oh, okay.
The red thingy is the gene. Mm-hmm. So what is dad? So bacteriophage is a virus that will get into a bacteria. Mm-hmm. So what his dad did is he got a red thingy, which is a gene, and he put it into the blue thingy, which is the capsule. It's the protein coat. And then that blue thingy went into a bacteria.
And
then the bacteria produced the protein, its own protein, which it had taken the genetic code into its own thingy.
Yeah, so the gene is...
Black thingy.
Inserted into the bacteria. The bacteria does the bacteriophage's job for it.
That's it. And then a yellow thingy... Well, no, then the... It's a red thingy. It's another red thingy. That becomes the protein on top. So the way he did it was that the protein cut was on the outside of the bacteria. So then he had a yellow thingy, which is an antibody, to come and lift it off like a crane. And when he took that out, he also got the genetic code for that protein. So he got a double whammy. He kind of worked out how to get the protein, so he got the bacteria to create a new protein, and then he also got the genetic coding for it, so he could recreate it. I was like, wow, how cool is that?
Yep. I still don't understand it, I'm not going to lie. But, you know, Hillary...
do.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got no time to explain it again, but our Hillary thought that was a success, and it became a bit of a running theme throughout term. So the following week, a news report led Sam and Gina to get into some quite complicated biology, and Hillary, ever the science communicator, thought that she would try and clarify the situation. We begin with Madeline's news report.
Two healthy mice with two mothers have been born for the first time in a study that pushes the boundaries of reproductive science. There is no imminent prospect of the techniques being used clinically in people, but the findings demonstrate that the biological barriers to same-sex reproduction can, technically, be overcome.
What they had to do was gene edit them, and they removed these things called gene imprints, which is the normal biological mechanism to control what happens when DNA, or a haploid set of DNA from a mother, mixes with a father. Now, I must admit, I don't know a huge amount about what gene imprinting is. So I was hoping to bring that to the floor and asking you guys, what is the role of gene imprinting and why do you need to delete certain things?
So gene imprinting can be one of many things at the molecular level. It could be that certain genes are turned on or turned off by adding little either methylation tags or modifications to the proteins that the DNA is wrapped around. This is a field of epigenetics, but this actually, some genes in the females need to be turned off so that when they come together with the male chromosome, they complement each other. And if they don't complement each other, say when you're trying to combine a female genome with a male with another female genome, the same imprints, the same pieces of DNA are turned on or off. That means that there's no complement, there's no other halves. So I think in this story, the research has removed all these tags, these methylation marks or protein modifications, so they had a blank slate, sort of, so they didn't affect each other.
That sounds amazing. I mean, I was just thinking, did anyone hear my yellow thingy thing last time about the mobile?
I did.
I kind of feel we needed a yellow thingy thing there, because those tags are sort of yellow, aren't they, probably?
Probably.
Yeah?
Like post-it notes.
Post-it notes. So kind of, let's get some analogy going here. So we've got post-it notes on the female ones,
yeah.
And then they're yellow, and then we've got some red post-it notes on the male ones, but they're different, and so they kind of work together. But if you've got two lots of yellow post-it notes, that's just too much yellow.
Yeah.
So basically,
if you got yellow and red, you make orange, and that's good. We want orange. Yeah. But if you've got two yellows or two reds, that's it won't result in a viable pup.
Wow.
So they have to remove all the post-it notes before putting them back on.
Oh, God, that was so funny.
And Gina stayed so calm.
Didn't she? She was the only one in the room that was following, I think.
She was like, yes, yeah, so we'll just remove the post-it notes and then, you know, we have to amend it before we get a viable pup.
I mean, it makes complete sense, really, doesn't it?
That was brilliant. Anyway, well, we think we were brilliant. One of my favourite moments on the radio this year was when we managed to get hold of Professor Bruce Malumed from King's College for an interview regarding his research on the anthropogenic causes of natural disasters. He was an absolute star, wasn't he?
He was indeed. Let's hear what he had to say.
If we talk about which of the anthropogenic processes might trigger the most natural hazards, that would be vegetation removal, because it can trigger landslides and snow avalanches and drought and ground heave and storms and extreme temperature heat, because it creates its own microclimate. And so that is one that we think about. And if we go back to something like fracking, which I know is very topical right now, you know, that's actually, it's triggering earthquakes, but the earthquakes are tiny. You know, it's more oil and gas extraction that we're worried about triggering the bigger earthquakes, the magnitude 3 and 4. And so if we think about what would cause the most different kinds of natural hazards, it would be vegetation removal that we would be more worried about. And so often it's these, I would say, more emotive things like fracking, which catch the public's eye, mainly because they're scared of something they're not aware of and they don't see it around them. Whereas vegetation removal, people think, oh yeah, no big deal. We're doing that all the time. Let's not worry about it. But actually that's causing quite a bit of catalyzing and triggering natural hazards.
I've got a follow-on question to that. Does it differ by country which hazard is the worst? So I'm thinking some of those things in England perhaps are not as prevalent, say, as in the kind of mountainous regions.
Yeah, so I think more on the lines of anthropogenic processes will differ by country. And I do work in the global south, in Malawi, in Kenya, in India. And one of the key items triggering landslides there are buildings and how we build and how we do our drainage networks. Now, this is an issue in the UK, but not as much an issue. And so we get to the global south, where in some countries, not all countries, we have very poor enforcement or very poor understanding of how we build urbanization. A recent example was the floods in Kerala again, where for the large amount of water they had, they ended up accelerating the potential of landsliding because they released water from the reservoirs too quickly. And so they entered into an anthropogenic process there. And I think if this had been in the UK, they would have thought it through slightly differently in how they did it. So there are policies that aren't always thought through.
And that was great to hear from Professor Malamud. We were really, really fortunate to get him on Skype. It was a bit risky. We had a few seconds to go and Skype wasn't quite working properly, but I'm really glad we managed to get a hold of him and chat about all of these human causes of natural disasters. It's something I'd never really thought about before, and it was a really, really interesting report. And finally, a few weeks ago, Hillary was worried that our present sleep patterns are not good for our health. So iScience gave us some good tips on how to improve sleep. But how do you know if you have a problem? Hopefully this quiz will help.
So I'm going to read out five questions, and they have different scores, but the options I'm going to give you are none of the time, a little of the time, some of the time, a good bit of the time, most of the time, and all of the time. And it'll depend which way the question goes. Okay, so, slightly strangely worded this, I feel full of pep or energy. Okay, so you score a 6 if you're none of the time. A little of the time you get 5, some of the time you get 4, a good bit of the time 3, most of the time 2, all of the time 1. All of the time I feel full of pep or energy. Okay, I've got that one. Okay, next one, opposite way around. I feel tired and worn out, used up or exhausted. Say, none of the time you get a score of 1, a little of the time 2, some of the time 3, a good bit of the time 4, most of the time 5, all of the time 6. Yep. Okay. Mm-hmm. I wake up feeling fresh and rested. That goes 6-1. Okay, just choose yourself from 6. So I'll give you either end of the scale here. I feel like I wake up feeling fresh and rested none of the time. 6 or all of the time. 1. Irritating flatmate. Okay. Fatigue has interfered with my work, family and social life. None of the time you get a 1, all of the time you get a 6. Choose something between 1 and 6. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Fatigue has been one of my 3 most disabling symptoms. So I think if you take life as a series of health problems, I don't know, pain or asthma or kind of, you know, anything else you care to name, fatigue, is that the worst thing happening to you? So if it's the worst, go for one. Sure. If it's all of the none of the time, go for one. If it's all of the time, go for six.
Don't really have any disabling many disabling symptoms.
If it's, this is the one,
academic
then.
Academic work.
that's fatigue, isn't it?
That's part of it. Okay.
So I guess it is, yeah. I guess I would say.
So if it's your biggest problem, basically, yeah. Say, and none of the time go for one, all of the time go for six. Right, okay, time to bring in the scores. So I did this earlier and I scored a 13, which surprised me. So this cut-off, by the way, for needing help on this and being at a critical level is 17.5. So, okay, anyone prepared to share their levels?
I'm at 13 as well.
Ah, okay, snap.
I got 19.
Whoa! Okay, I'll just read this out for you, Danny. She's looking all right, actually. A score of 17.5 or more is felt to be critical level of identifying someone with fatigue that needs to be tackled systematically, probably using the scientific method. Anyone else?
Yep, 21.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Mind you, commuting to a course in London from Dublin, probably something to do with it.
Yeah.
Running two jobs.
That's probably something.
Something to do with it.
Yeah,
I'm
noticing a trend here.
Okay. So, now, folks, the rest of this programme is going to be about helping you. Oh, you go to sleep on your own and you wake each day with your thoughts and it scares you being alone. It's a last
resort. That's still such a fascinating quiz there, because I didn't actually do it at the time, 2 weeks ago. But I did it today, and I scored a 15, which I'm quite pleased
That's
about, actually.
Good.
I expected
Not
it
critical.
To be worse.
Yeah.
But what was really interesting is Hillary did it again in the studio.
Oh, I got 13 again.
She got the exact same.
That's interesting. Some of them shifted around. I think I feel a bit more tired because it's end of term, but no. I think I've been putting into practice some of the tips that we gave on the show. So we dim the lights around about 10 o'clock at night. So there was that definition on the show about whether you're a shift worker. If you're awake for 3 hours between 10 o'clock and 5 o'clock, so if you have bright light on or you're awake during that time, so plan after 10 o'clock, dim all the lights, try not to watch telly, and on your phone turn it on to night shift if it's an iPhone, or if it's an Android, there will be a setting for, and it turns into an amber light, so it's the blue lights that actually stimulate the back of the retina to wake you up.
Those are really interesting tips, and hopefully iScience can continue to provide lots of great tips on how to improve our health and all of those kind of things. Now, we are going to be speaking to the co-editor of the iScience magazine in just a little bit. But before then, I think we should talk about one of the most controversial TV adverts of recent months and days and years, in fact, actually, because it's kind of a science communication based advert. Back in November, I hosted the show and asked why the Iceland Christmas advert was banned. And here's what our panel of Aaron, Skylar and Kathy had to say.
The High Street Store's Christmas adverts have been coming out, but one in particular has been causing a lot of trouble. This one was banned by Ofcom before it even hit our screens. So let's take a little listen.
There's a orangutan in my bedroom and I don't know what to do. She plays with all my teddies and keeps borrowing my shoe. She destroys all of my houseplants and she keeps on shouting, ooh. She throws away my chocolate and she howls at my shampoo. There's a orangutan in my bedroom and I don't want her to stay. So I told the naughty orangutan that she had to go away. Orangutan in my bedroom, just before you go, why were you in my bedroom? I really want to know. There's a human in my forest, and I don't know what to do. He destroyed all of our trees for your food and your shampoo. There's a human in my forest, and I don't know what to do. He took away my mother, and I'm scared he'll take me too. There are humans in my forest, and I don't know what to do. They're burning it for palm oil, so I thought I'd stay with you. Orangutan in my bedroom. Now I do know what to do. I'll fight to save your home and I'll stop you feeling blue. I'll share your story far and wide so others can fight too. orangutan in my bedroom, I swear it on the stars. The future's not yet written, but I'll make sure it is ours.
Dedicated to the 25 orangutans we lose every day. Until all palm oil causes zero rainforest destruction, we're removing palm oil from all our own label products.
Kathy, why did this advert never make it to our living rooms?
Yeah, so the organisation called Clearcast, who oversee the Ofcom procedures, they banned it for being too political. And in doing so, Clearcast have prevented a crucial message being broadcasted to millions of viewers, many of whom buy products containing palm oil without actually knowing the devastation it's causing to animals and global warming. So, palm oil is about as unsustainable as it gets and contributes to habitat loss and the endangerment of species, including elephants, rhinos, tigers and orangutans. Palm oil is found in thousands of supermarket products, from biscuits to cosmetics to cleaning products, and it's integral to the global supply chain. Everyone is using it, but not actually knowing that what it is or if they are using it.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it before the advert came out or came out to us on the internet. And I think Iceland pledged to stop using palm oil by 2023, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah. So they are the first supermarket to have said so.
Iceland's been pretty good on that sort of stuff. So they decided to ban the use of plastics as packaging for all their food by 2023, I think, as well. Okay. So they're taking a lot of the steps in the right direction before there is sort of the law or the policy to force them to do it. So they're doing it off their own accord, and I think they'll win over quite a big customer base by doing that ahead of other supermarkets like Tesco or Sainsbury's.
Definitely. And the sort of online reaction to this advert has been overwhelmingly positive, I'd say.
It probably got more views because of the fact it was banned than if it had just been aired in the first place.
Yeah, it was definitely all over my newsfeed on Facebook. It's definitely created quite a stir.
So just how prevalent is palm oil in sort of our society?
The latest Greenpeace research found that 25 palm oil groups had cleared more than 130,000 hectares of rainforest in the last 3 years, while companies including Nestle, Johnson & Johnson, Unilever buy palm oil from companies deemed destructive by Greenpeace. So it's pretty prevalent. And I've actually got a quiz.
Woohoo!
Yeah. So, I'm going to read out the questions and then I'm going to give you an A, B or C. And let's see how it goes. So, question number one. What happened after France's environment minister, Ségolène Royal, urged people to stop eating Nutella because it contains palm oil? Is it A, Nigella Lawson invented a new Nutella gâteau recipe, prompting a British newspaper to rename her Nutella Lawson? Or is it B, Luca Galletti, Royal's Italian counterpart, told her to leave Italian products alone? Or C, a Google doodle of Nutella oozing onto a piece of toast appeared on the search engine?
I feel like it's going to be A. That's the sort of headline that you see, like the Daily Mail or the Sun going with. Or all of them. I don't know. Is that an option? Can I say all of them, or do I have to pick one?
It's one.
I love Nutella Lawson. I think that's brilliant.
I think
that's great. But I don't think it's true. I don't know.
So,
Skylar, what do you think?
Well, because I can see the screen, I do have it's a bit unfair, but if I had to guess, I would have guessed the Google one.
Don't give it away for the rest of us.
I would have guessed the Google one.
I think that implies it's not the Google one, so I think it's A.
I can in fact tell you it's B, with Luca Galletti, Royal's Italian counterpart, told her to leave Italian products alone.
I feel like they've just put two more interesting answers in the quiz, just to draw you in from the correct answer.
Okay, I'm going to do a couple more. In 2012, French senators tried to impose a 300% tax on palm oil, saying it was dangerously fattening and bad for the environment. What was the reaction? Was it A senator and owner of a bakery chain secretly stocked up on the oil in the week before the tax was imposed? Was it B, French actor Gerard...
Depardieu, let's go with that, staged a protest in support of La Bouffe Délicieuse Que Fait Grosso, which means delicious foods fattening or not. Or finally, is it C, The Measure was defeated and Le Monde journalist Luc Broner tweeted that an Italo-communist alliance had rescued the country.
I feel like it's not A, because I feel like it's just a good business decision to stock up on Nutella, so it wouldn't be that big a deal. But I'm not sure about the other two.
My ears perked up when I heard communist, so I'm going C.
So did mine, yeah. C, I think. Yeah.
I reckon B. I'm going to go with B.
Okay, well, I can tell you that Jason and Skylar are right with C.
That's not fair.
Okay, just this last question. So, the story of palm oil starts in the rainforest. A typical 4-square-mile patch of rainforest contains A, 25 species of tree, B, 150 species of tree, or C, 750 species of tree.
C. It's always the biggest with rainforests.
I'm going to go with B.
Yeah, I'm going to go with B, sort of eliminate the small and the big, go right down the middle.
Okay. Well, you are both wrong, but that's actually, Jason, you're right with 750.
Oh, so that only goes off when Jason's right. Me being right was a fluke last
time. Yeah, basically, I got the controls.
So what, I'm on a 0% correctness rate, you're on what, 33%, and Jason's up there with a 2/3
thing.
Okay, it's a fluke.
Skylar, did you want to mention some of the controversies surrounding palm oil?
Certainly. So one of the main things with palm oil is that you have to take into account a lot of these products need something, either palm oil or some sort of substitute, in order to exist. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't change our behavior to reduce how many items we consume that need those types of ingredients. But if we do need some type of ingredients, palm oil is actually one of the more energy efficient ones, and therefore it uses a bit less land than maybe some of the alternatives. So I'm thinking soya bean oil, for example. Things like that use quite a bit more land. Now, in addition, because it's more concentrated and because you can get more efficiency out of it, it's actually really great at generating income in pretty low income areas.
So the problem with palm oil is the fact that it can only be grown in certain conditions. And so those conditions are where we have rainforest. So you have to either choose between palm oil or rainforest. But actually, the alternatives, although they're less energy efficient, there's a lot more land available to grow those kind of alternatives. For example, we could always grow rapeseed oil here in the UK, but we can't grow palm oil in the UK. But if we were to grow rapeseed oil in the UK, then we don't have to rely on cutting down the rainforests in order to grow palm oil there.
Okay. We've had a listener comment in, actually. We've got Sophie, who says, I went to a jungle-themed Halloween party dressed as Doritos once because Doritos use palm oil. And the scariest thing about the jungle is the idea that they might not be there anymore.
It is a very scary thought.
I agree. And just to be explicit, I'm not a proponent, obviously, of tearing down the rainforest or of using it for our own nefarious purposes. But there is two sides to the argument, as most people recognize. Now, as far as the ad, though, I think that comes down to a different argument, which is, should we be able to communicate these? I think the ad is really effective, having sort of the nursery rhyme aspect to it, a cartoon. It's very relatable and accessible. I by no means think that that should have been taken down into the air, and we know that it's probably because of economic purposes.
Yeah, the reason why it was banned by Ofcom was the fact that it was deemed too political. To me, that doesn't appear political at all. I mean, it, nowhere does it mention sort of partisan issues. It doesn't mention any particular political party or affiliation. It is literally just promoting a message about trying to protect the environment. When did the environment become a political issue? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
And very good point. Very good point.
You have to keep in mind, though, that Ofcom is saying that it's a political issue explicitly. I think implicitly there's probably other reasons that they decided not to air it.
Hmm. I think it's a shame because it's Iceland is setting an example of how a retailer can attempt to help the issue rather than, shows that commercial interests and climate change don't have to be polar opposites.
Yeah, and I think that's one really big benefit right now is you're seeing that a lot more is people are really socially conscious of the products that they purchase and the effect that it has. More so at least than I've read or heard about in days past. So things like this campaign may not have gone over as well or may not have bolstered Iceland sales. I think you're going to see a dramatic increase in this upcoming holiday season because of that advert.
Yeah.
And do we think Ofcom, as the UK sort of standardising agency, do you think they should be allowing messages to be communicated like this, since we're one of the most economically developed countries? We should be promoting the message that the rainforest should be saved, surely.
I do have a problem with Ofcom and the fact that the BBC used to have its own regulatory body that was democratically sort of chosen, although internally it was chosen, but the fact that that's been now taken away and now they're relying on Ofcom, and so there is even less sort of public visibility and transparency within Ofcom than there was in the previous BBC regulator. And the fact of the matter is, we will never know why Ofcom chose to ban this. They may release a public statement, but we can't see the workings. We can't hold people accountable. And actually, if you look where the UK is on freedom of press index, there's a freedom of press index released every single year, and the UK, please correct me if I'm wrong, is somewhere between 40th and 50th in the world. We don't actually have that good freedom of press, that much transparency. And so I think this is just a real wake-up call to people. Why this shouldn't be banned? Why is it banned? What needs to be changed? I don't know if others agree with me on that.
I was just thinking, before the general election, don't they have their own advertisements coming out on TV?
Yeah, I think you're correct. I think so. The Labour Party and the Conservative Party and the Lib Dems and other parties as well release their own adverts. So why are those acceptable, but this is deemed unacceptable? Mm.
Yeah, there's very strict advert regulations around elections, you're right. It just seems bizarre that they're allowed to project these political messages. And we know from the past general election and the EU referendum, lots of them were based on lies and fake news. And this Iceland advert is not a lie. So why can't we see it? It's frustrating. It's really frustrating.
This is iScience Radio.
Wow, what a full discussion. And we're just saying, amazing panel members we've had this term. Now, we've been joined by Aoife, who's the co-editor of the iScience magazine, and alongside a job, the course, getting a new team together.
Getting injured.
Kind of
beware of lamps.
Jumping lamps in there. They have produced a beautiful looking production of Earth. Aoife, how did you do it?
I don't know. No, actually, organisation-wise, we were a little bit of a mess. First issue of the year probably was always going to be a little bit of a mess. But it was really our writers and our editors who really just pulled this off. The best part, I was trying to think earlier, I was like, oh, what do I do if they ask me, like, what was my favourite article? But I was thinking, my favourite part of this was when the articles would come in and I'd read them and I'd be just blown away at how well people here can construct a story and take topics which could be a little bit boring, like, you know, can we survive without insects, and making those into really meaty, juicy pieces.
Yeah, it's a fantastic magazine and there's so much great content in there, so congratulations for that. And I just think all of the stuff, you know, you see the title Earth and all of the stuff in there is so broad and there's so many different things. How come you came up with the Earth theme in the first place?
I toyed around. Earth was my choice. And I was toying around with, like, life on Earth, life of Earth. And my big thinking was, we only have one planet that we know of that has ever produced life. And granted, there may be other planets out there. We don't know yet. More than likely, there is somewhere.
Oh, we talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah, we
did. It was
did.
The green. Yeah, green and purple. Ooh. Theory. Nothing yellow.
Sorry. It's in here. There's the Goldilocks article by Katie Pallister, which is all about that, in this issue. Check it out. But it was like, you know, we kind of take Earth for granted. It is this little rock floating through space, spinning around, and it's produced all of this, all of us, all these discussions we can have. It is everything to us. We would be nothing without it, quite literally. So we're like, why not celebrate that? You know, celebrate this planet that we are continually destroying and probably making much worse than it deserves to be. And why not talk about that, but not talk about, you know, climate change is happening and we need to do something about that. Just talk about Earth is this really strange thing that happened. So let's celebrate every aspect of it that we can.
Yeah, I like how it isn't criticizing all of the, you know, the terrible human things that we've done to Earth, but it's mm-hmm. it's also saying we should do this, but it's not pushing this. And I think that's really great, the iScience magazine.
Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. And I must say, the illustrations, and a lot of them done by people in our course.
Almost all of the pictures were from our course. It was amazing. And like, there's some beautiful collages people did. The front cover, the cover illustration, was done by spray paint by Harry Lampert.
Cake Harry.
Cake Harry.
I call him, yes. Cake Harry. Yeah, because we have two Harrys on the course.
Great. Well, congratulations on the magazine, Aoife. That's really tremendous. And any ideas what the next one's going to be about?
Next one will either be
exclusive
magic or bad science.
Ooh.
We haven't decided yet. One or the other. And thank you guys for having me on and putting together such a wonderful radio show all semester. Hopefully it will only get better throughout the rest of the year, but it has been great so far.
Thank you. And we'll be ripping the next topic to shreds as we did this time and find out what we can inspire for your new writers.
Every
about.
Other week we've been hosting topics around the... So writers can come on and talk and listen to the show or try out ideas with us.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I actually got a lot of the ideas for my philosophy essay from this show. So, you know, it's very useful. It's very useful. So now it's time to talk a little bit about the future. We've covered a lot this term on the future, but I think we can all agree that Hilary and Cathy's transhumanism experience was definitely a highlight. Here's what happened.
Transhumanism is the belief that it is both possible and desirable to so fundamentally alter the human condition through the use of technologies as to become a super post-human being. Myself and Cathy went to a talk at the Guardian events on transhumanism. What I thought they were talking about was probably post-human, where they talk about this completely different world where brains are disembodied, where the body is a fashion statement, really. So you could have your brain put into a dog or a cat. And so that was everything that we know is up for grabs, and it's all changed. Whereas I think, but they called the talk transhumanism. So there was very little about what I would say was transhumanism. It was more post, but so it seems to merge.
I'm in complete shock, really. Didn't really realise how much transhumanism encompasses. I sort of had quite a narrow view on what it was, and my mind has been a bit opened.
So what did you think it was before you came, and what do you think it is now?
I thought it was sort of just the merging between human and machine, but I thought of it as sort of in a more materialistic way, as in the literal tangible merging of human body and machine. So sort of like prosthetics arms or what have you, but there's a whole sort of different range of categories to which humanism falls under.
Erita calls herself a transhumanist, and she has great plans for her future.
To be honest, I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind being transferred. I would like to, you know, experience that. But I would also have the opportunity to say, you know, I had enough. I've had my experience. Just turn me off now.
What's the advantage of being uploaded and then switching yourself off when you want to, compared to just letting death come to you when it's ready?
To be honest, like, I don't mind death coming for me. If it happens tomorrow, I'm fine, as long as I felt that I lived long enough and seen enough and experienced enough. So if we don't get there before my time, I'm okay. If we get there, I want to see what's beyond, how the process works, what I can achieve when I get to that point. The same way, if you could increase your brain capabilities and gain superpowers, you'd like to be able to, you know, test it before maybe giving it up because it's not for you, right? So there will always be, I hope, the free choice of being who you are and whatever you want to be.
To kick things off, Hilary asked our panel if they would want to become a transhuman.
Are you happy with the version of yourself, or would you like to have a better version of yourself? Anyone?
Well, that's a deep question. I've never thought about sort of going further past death. I feel like if you put your all into this life, you know, that would be fulfilling for me.
Anyone else want to become a perfect, the most perfect version of themselves?
I don't think so. I quite like my sort of quirks about myself. I don't really want to be. Well, maybe I don't like them, but I don't think you.
What makes you human, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that we should value being human rather than try and create something perfect. I don't think that's really something desirable.
Transhumanism encompasses both physical changes, like biohacking, and intellectual changes, changes to our brain. In the studio, we explored what this would mean.
I know a person who has a bionic arm, and lots of amputees or veterans are actually choosing to get these devices attached to their body because it obviously replaces the lost limb, but in a way it actually enhances the limb. Like, it's much stronger, and it can sometimes can be more mobile. And the way his arm works is it's connected by electrodes to his arm muscles, because he only has his lower arm missing from a blood poisoning incident when he was young. And the electrodes are attached to his upper arm muscles, so when he flexes and contracts them, they send an electrical signal down to the arm to then do the movement that he wants. So it's amazing technology, and that they're constantly improving. So you could actually choose to get something like this added onto you as an enhancement.
I think it's sort of easy to get into when there's a deficit. And I think when we were at the talk, Cathy, Mark O'Connell was saying, well, that's just medicine. But it seems they merge. So if you have a bionic arm because you want one, that's transhumanism. But if you have one because you're an amputee, that's medicine.
Yeah, I think a lot of the transhumanism is about the desire as well. So not necessarily the circumstance, but the desire to want to improve yourself.
But in a way, if the technology is developed for amputees, it can then also be used for those that want to replace parts of their body.
I think this amputee thing is really interesting, because if you're an amputee and you get this kind of bionic arm or leg or whatever it is, do you still identify as 100% human? When do you cross the boundary of not identifying as 100% human?
Yeah. What does that mean for your passport?
Nightmare through security.
Absolutely.
Gina also talked about adding senses to our bodies.
There's a Spanish man called Manuel Muñoz, and he calls himself a perceptual artist, and he has a cybernetic organ attached to his head and his brain and his ear, and he actually senses changes in atmospheric pressure. So it's a barometer of sorts, and does that by sensing vibrations in his ear and measuring those and relaying those to his brain.
Why?
Yeah, that's what I've written. Like, what's the point?
Is he a weatherman? That'd be quite useful if you're a weatherman.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, Michael Fish.
Yeah, so his webpage actually says that he can sense changes in weather, especially the arrival of cyclones, and tell at what altitude he's in. And, yeah, it's just, he's actually started a society called the Trans Species Society, and it's for people who don't identify as 100% human. So he's doing this society is doing research into what other senses you can add to the human body. So he's added the sort of atmospheric sensing.
So one thing I alluded to earlier was that some people are implanting magnets into their fingertips. And while it also is a really cool party trick, you can pick things up with your magnets. In addition to that, they want to be able to use the magnets in order to sense magnetic fields. So imagine you have another sense where you can sense magnetic fields, You can even use it to sense other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum that we don't have access to right now with our traditional senses, eyes, ears, etc.
Which bits are those?
Infrared, ultraviolet are some that people have alluded to using magnets in order to be able to pick up or sense to some capacity.
I was thinking that some people think magnetic fields are bad for them.
Yeah, so I feel like there's a bit of mixed response. So it's very trendy, or at least it was a while back, to get wristbands that had magnets on both sides, at least in the States. I'm not so much sure out here. Also, magnets behind the ears are also very popular in Ayurvedic medicine. So they're thought to have some restorative effects. So I think restorative or negative, there's sort of different beliefs around how magnets present themselves.
Hillary then asked our special guest expert, Paul Martinenko, the previous president of the British Computing Society, about the intellectual side of transhumanism.
Just what are the prerequisites so that we can put computers in our brains? Does anyone know? Paul, start us off.
So there are a lot of technical problems. The brain isn't a very happy place to put technology. I mean, it's salty, it's hot, and it's damp, and traditional technology isn't very comfortable in that. Similarly, the brain doesn't like things you put in it, and why would you do that anyway? Okay, so there's an awful lot to do first, and whether you want to do it or not is a big question. If you look at AI today, and you talk about artificial general intelligence, you know, trying to replicate a human being, then people will talk about that being very far away and actually something that's not worked on. Okay, so what people are really focusing on is helping people do their jobs with artificial intelligence, which, you know, is pattern recognition, which is systems which help them come up with better decisions and so on. So it's not a case of trying to replace a human being, it's trying to put something alongside them. Now, I guess what you're describing by putting a computer in the brain is taking that box and then plugging it straight into the head. Well, that's got to be a long way away, okay? Not just for the physical attributes of the environment you might be putting in, and do you really want to put something inside somebody's head? But actually, understanding how the brain works. I mean, you know, if you assume there's more than 80 billion neurons in there and each neuron is connected to about 10,000 others, how do you map that? You know, how do you know when a neuron fires what exactly is it's trying to do? Now, we have some evidence and we have some examples of people who can, for example, put a small number of electrodes into the motor neurons, into the motor cortex, and then when they fire, it knows whether somebody's trying to move a finger or raise an arm. And they're doing that with paraplegic people today who, you know, are able to then raise a cup.
Gina was telling us about a friend with a robotic arm.
Yeah, so those things are good, but you've got wires coming out of their head. And you know, and you've got a highly competent neuroscientist standing next to them making sure it works. That's not scalable. So you're looking at wireless devices, you're looking at mapping the brain, you're looking at doing a whole set of things. And then you've got a massive set of ethics as to whether you're going to actually give someone that level of advantage, okay? Or whether you're going to potentially do harm. Never say never, okay? Never say never in technology. If there's a business case, people will go for it. You know, Elon Musk has said that we need to do something like this if we're to stay at a point where computers don't take over. But this is looking, you know, a long way ahead. So never say never.
So never say never. Jason, thanks. That was a great package. Thanks for putting that together.
No, thank you for going to the conference for us and providing us with all that great content on transhumanism. It was a fantastically interesting show. And also, thank you very much to our listeners today. We've heard from listener number one, who says, was Santa a scientist and were her reindeer her lab assistants? Uh-huh. And thanks to Dr. Dan and Gina for listening and I hope you have a great Christmas and a well-deserved break.
And don't go away yet. I know we're nearly coming up to the hour, but if you hang on in there, we have an absolutely smashing bonus feature for you when Bernadetta went to the Green of Eight Festival.
Yeah, it was one of our favourite things, and it shows how beer can be carbon neutral and we can still enjoy it in the future.
Whew, okay. After all this science, I definitely need a drink. Anyone for a pint? But did you know that alcoholic beverages account for 1.5% of UK's greenhouse gas emissions? So it's only right that Greenovate event also had some zero-carbon beer at hand.
I'm a PhD student at Imperial studying mathematics. We are brewing carbon-neutral beer, so sustainable beer that has net zero emissions.
So what do you do to make it zero emissions?
So it's actually really simple stuff. We use renewable energy for the brewing itself. All of the bottles are reused bottles. The ingredients are locally sourced and we collect them by cycling or some other kind of transport. This is only our second batch. Yeah, so exclusive. So at the moment we're just doing it in someone's house. It's not illegal if we don't sell it.
Can we try some?
Yes, please do.
Bottles look very nice and stylish.
Thank you.
And a tasting cup looks very elegant. I'm not sure if it's appropriate for beer, but it tastes like beer. Surprise, surprise.
I've never actually tried it myself, but
how come?
So I'm a celiac, so I can't eat gluten.
Oh,
so
what a pity!
This whole process is a bit of a moot point for me, but from what I've heard, it's good.
Oh, there we go. You still do good without even tasting it.
Thank you.
That was refreshing. And there you have it. From recycling to air cleanup, scientists working hard to innovate and bring new solutions for a better and sustainable future.
Thank you, Bernadetta. What was your favourite one, everyone?
Oh, I thought the CO2-free beer was quite a cool. Yeah,
but the poor guy, they have to cycle all the way to Kent to get their ingredients.
Oh, wow.
It was, and he never even tasted his own beer, which was really disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't get a car. Jason, yeah.
I feel his pain. As a celiac, I do feel his pain.
There we go.
Was it actually good beer, by the way, Bernadetta?
So I did taste it. The problem is that I don't drink, so, you know, it tasted to me like beer. So I can't, I'm definitely not a connoisseur for beer. So it tasted like beer, I can tell you that, but whether it's good or not, you'll have to find some Imperial exclusive.
So for everyone listening, that's what we're going to do after the show, is find these men and drink their beer.
The radio show where we talk about science, we have fun with science, and we play some really cool records. This is iScience Radio. And that was October to December. What a great term it's been. We start again 7th of January and we're going to have alternating guest editor and producers.
Yeah, that's going to be great. I can't wait for the next year of iScience Radio. And thank you to everyone who's listened over the last term, and we'll see you again in 2019.
Woo!
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
iScience Radio, online at iSciencemag.co.uk. Follow us on Twitter at iScience Media.